edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Web Wisdom Bonanza, Planned Obsolescence, Not All Conspiracies Are False, Doctors, Conflict of Interest, The End of Everything, UN Climate Change Report, What Happened to Olivia Chow in Toronto. Let's begin episode 272.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort from politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week, let's start off with a look at planned obsolescence. Ever get that feeling that things are built to break? Well, you may not be too far off. Let's listen and learn.
Why would a company purposefully make a piece of crap and sell it to you?
You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
This week, we are exploring suppressed technology and planned obsolescence. Planned obsolescence is just, you know, the $50 word for pretty crooked strategy. Why not, instead of making something that works all the time, we make something that is purposefully designed to break after a certain amount of time or usage? I know, right? Sounds a little bit villainous, but if you're an oligopoly, or if you're a company in an oligopoly, it makes sense. In an oligopoly, only a few players, whether they're people or companies or governments, actually make something or control what people can buy. So, for instance, Matt, what's a thing that people make?
Customizable drum gloves.
Right. Thank you. Perfect. Customizable drum gloves. So let's say just me and one other guy, how about you, Matt, are the only people who make customized drum gloves. Well, we don't want to make customized drum gloves that never break, because then we'll be putting ourselves out of a job, won't we? So in a way, it makes sense for us to work together to figure out when these drum gloves should actually break. When's the best possible time to make somebody buy some more? And when companies are in a more competitive space, when you as a consumer have more choices about where you'll buy what, then this planned obsolescence strategy doesn't make as much sense, because why would you buy something, again, that is built to break? It's a villainous strategy. I think that's a fair word to use. And in some circles, it is very popular. In 1932, this guy named Bernard London wrote a pamphlet called Ending the Depression Through Planned Obsolescence, which I imagine is how he talked back then. And the idea was this: the U.S. government should legally put an obsolescence period, pretty much an expiration date, on products so that when companies built them, they had to break within that period of time. And then, London argues, it would restart the economy because more people would have to, you know, break their drum gloves, and then they would have to buy more drum gloves. This idea didn't really pan out, but planned obsolescence survived, and there are a couple of different ways that companies can do this to you, the consumer. For instance, one thing would be using inferior components in a place where they're crucial, like plastic instead of metal, or screws that are designed to just after a certain amount of time. And then, of course, if you've ever bought a smartphone, you already know about irreplaceable batteries. They have a finite amount of charges, and then at some point, it's cheaper to buy a new phone than to replace the battery sometimes. And then, of course, let's not forget the plethora, and I'm using that word correctly, of disposable items. Razor blades, lighters, those single-use cameras. These create a mountain of waste, but they're pretty popular with companies that sell them. And for our purposes, one of the most important examples of this would be when a company uses its political or economic clout to purposely sell an inferior product or suppress a superior product from coming out. We've looked at examples of this in several different episodes. You know, the great rail car conspiracy, where automakers purchased electric-powered public transit systems and then junked them. And then the current war. I mean, not a war going on today, but the war of the currents between Tesla and Edison, AC and DC. This even goes back to the emergence of the refrigerator, when ice truck cartels worked to keep you, or I guess more likely your ancestors, from having a refrigerator in your home. And then ink cartridges. You There's also the idea that college textbooks have planned obsolescence. And for anyone who's been to college, you've probably encountered that thing where you have to say, wait, why do I need this $150 edition again? Spoiler alert for everybody who's planning on going to college soon. Good luck, guys. And then we get into gray territory when we talk about consumer electronics. I mean, do you think that Apple has planned obsolescence? Are they purposely building things that will be crappier and crappier so you have to buy the new one? And those are allegations, by the way, that are pretty popular and mainstream at this point. They've been mentioned more than once in the New York Times. And the big question for a lot of us, I know for Matt and I, would be what about video games and video game consoles and software? We know there's a little bit of obsolescence planned in there because games from previous consoles will often not be backwards compatible, even when it would be easy from an engineering point to do so. And then there's the whole thing about what you buy when you buy a video game. Are you buying the physical game? Do you own it? Or do you just sort of rent a license to play that game? One of the big fights about suppressing technology now in the modern age would be the fight between internet service providers and Google Fiber. And make no mistake, it's a war. But is it a market war, or is it an actively suppressed technology? Which brings us to the big question of the week. Has there ever been a real-life proven case of a company suppressing a widespread superior technology? Ladies and gentlemen, the answer is yes, and we're covering it. Stay tuned on one of the first proven conspiracies to create an inferior product and make you pay more for it.
On the heels of that, a case study, a real-life conspiracy to prevent innovations in light bulbs. Let's see what we can learn.
You can turn back now, or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. Here are the facts. Electric light profoundly and fundamentally changed the nature of human existence. Where before, even the world's most important leaders relied on imperfect fires and candles to stave off darkness, now the majority of the human species has access to cheap, abundant light. Like most technological advances, light bulbs didn't start out perfect. They were terribly inefficient, fragile, and often short-lived. Luckily, inventors around the world have been working nonstop to make more efficient, durable, and better bulbs, right? Here's where it gets crazy. You may have never heard of the Phoebus Cartel, but it remains one of the most illuminating stories in the history of global economics. While Humphrey Davy is often credited with making the first incandescent light bulb in the early 1800s, the commercial designs that sprang into being over the next century were far more sophisticated than his original invention. And these commercial lamps were made by a number of manufacturers, companies like Osram, Philips, General Electric, and more. These businesses banded together in 1924 to form a Swiss corporation called the Phoebus Cartel. Each company had a number of shares in proportion to their percentage of the international lamp market. Officially, the Phoebus Cartel existed to regulate the production of light bulbs. Yet according to multiple experts, this group existed instead to carve up the worldwide incandescent light bulb market, with each national and regional zone assigned its own manufacturers and production quotas. According to Marcus Krajowski, writing for Spectrum, this was the first cartel in history to enjoy a truly global reach. The cartel also conspired to fix prices and to enforce uniform quality, but perhaps not in the way you would assume. At the time of the cartel's formation, some light bulbs lasted longer than others, up to 1,500 or even 2,000 hours. Phoebus decreed that all light bulbs made by the cartel should last 1,000 hours. They purposely worked to create bulbs with a shorter lifespan while simultaneously conspiring to drive up the price of the product. As the cartel worked to undo decades of progress, they also worked to police one another. All factories had to send bulbs to a central testing facility in Switzerland, and if any factory sent bulbs lasting less or more than 1,000 hours, the factory was fined and had to pay a fee. Companies were also penalized if they exceeded their sales quotas. Eventually, this gave rise to a surreptitious war between each company's engineers and upper management. The engineers and scientists attempted to quietly increase the lifespan of a bulb by changing the voltage, for instance, before the cartel caught wind. For a time, this cartel was enormously successful. Between 1926 to 1934, the lifespan of the average bulb in these factories dropped from 1,800 to 1,205 hours. Sales climbed for the first few years. However, the cartel's profits could not continue forever. By 1940, competition from non-cartel members, expiring patents, legal attacks, and the looming threat of World War II spelled doom for this organization, and its agreement was nullified in 1940. Today, the Phoebus cartel is openly acknowledged, but this wasn't always the case. It may seem bizarre that a group would work so tenaciously to enforce planned obsolescence, pursuing inferior products for a temporary boost to the bottom line, but that appears to be the case. Modern laws are supposedly crafted to prevent these practices today, but as more and more consumers find themselves confronted with a lack of choice in one market or another, they have to ask themselves, have cartels really gone away, or is there something global manufacturers don't want you to know?
The ordinary, everyday people who invested their savings and gave the young power industry strength to expand. They, the share owners, as much as the inventors and engineers, brought about a great revolution. When a world that had plodded down the centuries suddenly found out how to use a force that had waited to go to work since before the daybreak of history.
Well, maybe no Illuminati, but you can understand why we should feel a little suspicious of corporations. We'll be back after this break.
That ship out there will be smashed to bits. Use your emergency equipment.
It won't work. Nothing works. It's got to. It's no use. Everything seems to be stuck.
My life's worth a try anyway.
Come on, fellas. You can make it.
Just listen to this. Spider-Man saves freighter. You can't tell me the captain couldn't have brought his ship in without the help of that publicity-seeking show-off, Spider-Man!
Don't get caught wasting power. Unplug cell phone, camera, and other battery chargers when charging is complete. Many electronic devices continue to use power even when you are not operating them. The amount of energy consumed by electronics in a year when they were not in use could power Whistler Blackcomb Resorts for 43 years. This Power Smart play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
And we're back. Building on the theme that not all plots are phantoms, there's been growing concerns with the influence of pharmaceutical companies on doctors, especially in the area of thinly veiled, if indirect, briberies we call speaking fees. Let's listen and see what we can learn.
I'm a doctor. My father's a doctor. My colleagues are doctors. The people I train are doctors. Lots and lots of my friends are doctors. But that doesn't mean that doctors sometimes aren't blind to certain issues like their own financial conflicts of interest. Sometimes we have to poke doctors with a stick. That's how we show our love. Conflicts of interest are the topic of this week's healthcare triage. When the Food and Drug Administration creates an advisory committee to help it decide whether or not to approve drugs, It often asks academic physicians to serve on the committees as external experts. This is supposed to help the committee render judgments that are unbiased and scientific. Physicians can, therefore, hold a fair amount of sway in how decisions are made. One would hope that they'd be above reproach, coming to the committee's deliberations with equipoise and an open mind. A study published recently by Genevieve Pham Cantor in the Milbank Quarterly brings that assumption into question. She reviewed the voting behavior and financial interests of almost 1,400 FDA advisory committee members who took part in decisions for the Center for Drug and Evaluation Research from 1997 to 2011. Over that time, 15,739 votes took place in 379 meetings. On average, 13% of participants on each committee had some reported financial interest in a drug company whose product was up for review by that committee. About half of all meetings had at least one participant with such a financial interest. About a third of these interests involved consulting of some kind, but one quarter included an ownership interest, and 14% involved a committee member who served as a member of an industry advisory board or steering committee. She found that overall, committee members had a 52% chance of voting in favor of the sponsor of a drug, but members who had financial interest in only the company whose product was under deliberation were more likely to vote for its approval, with a probability of 63%. If members served on advisory boards for only the company whose product was up for review, then the chance they'd vote in favor of it shot up to 84%. It's hard to look at data like these and not be concerned about conflicts of interest. There's a reason the 10-cent coupons exist. It's because they work. Financial interests absolutely do influence our decision-making. Since 2008, the FDA has worked to reduce the number of committee members with financial conflicts of interest, and the Pham-Cantor study indicates that this effort has met with some significant success. Other conflicts of interest, like professional or ideological ones, can also influence our behavior, but those haven't been studied as well. And the FDA is not the only place where financial conflicts of interest are a concern. Financial relationships between doctors and industry are not uncommon. In 2007, research showed that 94% of physicians in the United States had such relationships. More than 80% of doctors had accepted gifts, and 28% had received payments for consulting or research. 60% of those physicians were in medical education, and 40% were involved in writing practice guidelines. Physicians sometimes travel to nice resorts for education. A study published some time ago in the journal Chest followed doctors who went to two all-expenses-paid symposia on new drugs. 85% of the physicians interviewed stated that accepting such invitations would not influence their use of the drugs. Nevertheless, their prescriptions for those drugs nearly tripled after the meetings, far above increases in the use of those drugs seen nationally. Other studies have shown that physicians who meet with and accept gifts from drug companies are significantly more likely to ask that their drugs be added to hospital formularies. In the past, potential conflicts of interest were not discussed widely in public. Many patients were unaware that physicians accepted gifts from pharmaceutical companies. When they learned that such exchanges occurred, they reported that it, quote, altered their perception of the medical profession. Patients also felt that gifts are more influential and less appropriate than doctors did. This sentiment is one of the reasons that the Physicians Payments Sunshine Act was passed with bipartisan support in the United States. The law, which went into effect last year, requires that almost all payments made by industry to physicians be reported to a public database. These include things like meals, travel, honoraria for speaking, grants for research, and ownership in companies. It's hoped that by making these types of relationships public, we might mitigate some of their effects. Doctors have had mixed reactions to those changes. Data like those now required by law to be reported were recently used to show that top Medicare prescribers of the expensive drug Acthar had financial ties to its maker. The doctors mentioned by name in that article probably didn't appreciate their loss of anonymity. Many others have already begun to limit their acceptance of gifts, knowing that they'll soon be made public. Some physicians, especially those opposed to the Sunshine Act, believe that they should be responsible for regulating themselves. But our thinking about conflicts of interest isn't always rational. A study of radiation oncologists found that only 5% thought that they might be affected by gifts, but a third of them thought that other radiation oncologists would be affected. Another study asked medical residents similar questions. More than 60% of them said that gifts could not influence their behavior, but only 16% believed that other residents could remain uninfluenced. This magical thinking that somehow we ourselves are immune to what we're sure will influence others is why conflict of interest regulations exist in the first place. We simply cannot be accurate judges of what's affecting us. Conflicts of interest are real, and they are still influencing decisions from the level of the patient all the way up to national health policy. We won't ever be able to eliminate them all, but acknowledging them and talking about them openly is an important first step toward minimizing their impact.
Well, what better way to take our minds off doctors and their conflicts of interest than contemplating the end of everything? No, I mean everything. Let's listen.
You know how this is gonna end, right? Like you and your guinea pig and the bacteria living in your bathtub and the Real Housewives franchise, all those things are gonna end. And of course you know that, but also big, permanent-seeming things are gonna end, like the Earth and the Sun and this galaxy and that galaxy over there and the universe. The end's not gonna happen anytime soon, but give it some time and even the universe will change into something different, something we wouldn't even recognize, and then gone. How exactly that's going to happen is, of course, up for some serious debate, because what we don't know about the universe could fill, like, a universe. But astrophysicists, cosmologists, and particle physicists are pretty smart people, and they think about this all the time. So at this point, what do they think is going to happen to Earth and to the solar system and the universe in the far distant future? It's good stuff to know, you know, just in case you happen to run out of other stuff to worry about. The universe is about 13.7 billion years old, give or take about 130 million years, but it hasn't always been the way it is now. It's believed that it was born with the Big Bang as an unfathomably hot, dense point called a singularity. The Big Bang didn't occur as an explosion, like you would think, even though it's called the Big Bang. And the universe didn't expand into space because space didn't exist before the universe was formed. Instead, think of the Big Bang as the simultaneous appearance of space everywhere in the universe. You know, if you could picture that. I, for one, cannot. But the people who study this stuff say that the universe hasn't expanded from any one spot since the Big Bang, but that space itself has been stretching and carrying matter with it. So, the universe started at a single, hot, dense point smaller than an electron or something, and at the ripe old age of a hundredth of a billionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second, this point began to expand faster than the speed of light in a process called inflation. It's thought that in the same instant, the universe doubled in size at least 90 times, growing from the size of a subatomic particle to the size of a golf ball. Ta-da! Whole universe! From there, it continued to grow a little more slowly, and as it expanded, it cooled, and matter began to form. For instance, just 1 second after the Big Bang, the fundamental building blocks of matter, called quarks, start to assemble into subatomic particles like protons and neutrons. And for the next 380,000 years or so, as the universe continued to cool and become less dense, these particles began to structure themselves in a way that we would recognize. They started colliding to form atoms, protons and neutrons inside a nucleus tied up together with a tidy little orbit of electrons. Here, some of the first lightest elements like helium, lithium, and of course hydrogen began to appear. At this point, the universe transformed from a dense fog of particles into something transparent. But it also went completely black, since no stars had yet formed. So the period between 380,000 years to about 400 million years after the Big Bang is what we call the cosmic dark ages, since there weren't any big objects emitting visible light yet. But for the next half billion years after that, clumps of gas began to collapse enough to form the first stars and galaxies. The expansion of the universe gradually slowed as gravity tried to pull matter back in on itself, but then, about 3.5 billion years after the Big Bang, something weird started to happen. A force stronger than gravity began to overpower this pull and accelerate the expansion of the universe. This force, called dark energy, is a leading candidate for the title of least understood thing in physics. All we really know is that it's a repulsive force that causes the universe to expand at an ever-increasing rate. So at this point, you probably get why the fate of the universe is so tough to predict. Our information is profoundly incomplete. We keep finding out about stuff like dark energy, and we're like, oh, okay. That's gonna take a minute to process. Anyway, a little south of 9 billion years after the Big Bang, our solar system was born, and then our little adorable planet showed up. And here we are. But what's gonna happen to us?
Because everything ends. I mean, the second law of thermodynamics tells us that as time passes, entropy, that is, disorder in general, increases on all levels. Stars, including our sun, exhaust their supplies of fuel. Planets come untethered from their stars and galaxies break apart.
We're not 100% sure about anything regarding the true nature of the universe, so the end could happen in a different way. In fact, a lot of really smart people think it will happen differently. But one thing pretty much everybody agrees on, there's almost certainly going to be an end.
But here on Earth, we've got some things besides cold, black nothing to worry about. Even if the end of everything does happen, you won't be around for it. Neither will I, and neither will our great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandkids. They'll be past caring one way or another.
Because on Earth, things are always changing. It's what makes life possible. But it can also be kind of unconducive to immortality, if you know what I mean.
In the next 100,000 years, Niagara Falls will erode away into Lake Erie, the moon will slow down the rotation of the Earth enough that we'll have to add a leap second to our clocks every day,
and if global warming doesn't tamper with it, we're due for another ice age.
Oh, and the movement of the stars will render most of the constellations we see from Earth unrecognizable,
which will make astrologers, presumably, really confused.
In the next 1 million years, our planet is due for a good old-fashioned catastrophic extinction event. These have happened periodically over the past 4 billion years of Earth's history. It could be the eruption of a supervolcano, which have been frequent enough to change the game in terms of the history of life on Earth.
Think of an explosion so major that sulfuric acid mixed with volcanic ash blocks the sun all over the world for like 10 years and sends the planet into a volcanic winter.
It's happened before, lots of times. We've even survived one before, although barely. Some scientists think that the eruption of the Toba supervolcano in Indonesia 70,000 years ago left only about 1,000 breeding pairs of Homo sapiens to repopulate the Earth. And did they ever?
Now, sometime in the next 100 million years, we're likely to be hit by a meteorite similar to the one that possibly killed off the dinosaurs, because things in space are not so far apart that they don't run into each other occasionally.
And big space rocks have collided with the Earth for as long as there has been an Earth. In fact, that's probably what caused most of the major extinction events on Earth so far.
Of course, some people think that we could destroy one of those space rocks before it punches us in the face, but who knows where humans will be, if anywhere, 100 million years from now.
250 million years from when you watch this, we will make a full circuit around the Milky Way, in which time all the continents on Earth may have fused into a single supercontinent.
And now we gotta start thinking about the sun getting bigger, because that's what's gonna happen next.
In 600 million years, the sun will begin to enter the red giant phase, basically a star's midlife crisis. A red giant has fused all its hydrogen into helium, causing it to heat up and expand to more than 100 times its original size. It'll take a few billion years for the sun to actually swallow the Earth, but its growing luminosity will probably cause enough climatic changes on Earth, like all the oceans evaporating, for instance, that in 1.3 billion years, all plants and animals will have gone extinct. And the only living things will be bacteria and archaea hanging out in little pockets of liquid water at the Earth's poles.
In 1.6 billion years, even those extremophiles will be having a tough time of it.
In about 3.5 billion years, the surface of the Earth will resemble that of Venus, and the Earth's orbit will widen with the growing, yet less massive, sun until about 7.9 billion years from now, when the sun will swallow up Mercury, Venus, and Earth.
Some researchers have suggested that if humankind has figured out how to survive that long, maybe we could lasso a passing asteroid and get a tow into wider orbit, or we could move on to one of Saturn's moons, like Titan, because at that point it might be a perfect place for us.
7.9 billion years, though, we are so not going to be around, but I love the optimism.
Anyway, 8 billion years from now, the sun will become a white dwarf, which by that point will be about half its present mass, and by 14.4 billion years from now, it will be cool enough to be invisible to human eyes.
It's been a good sun, though. You better appreciate while it's still keeping you warm.
After that, our solar system is pretty much dead. Now, it's kind of hard to say what will happen to the universe. Every astrophysicist's got ideas, of course, and each idea has a kind of painful nickname. The big rip, the big crunch, the big freeze. Which scenario will win out mostly depends on dark energy, which we don't know diddly about, if you remember.
Let's start with the big rip.
Here, the rate of expansion driven by dark energy keeps growing and growing without limit, becoming so extreme that it actually overwhelms all of the fundamental forces of physics, from the gravitation between objects to the strong and weak forces that hold subatomic particles together. In which case, not only will galaxy clusters break apart and star systems dissipate, but every form of matter, right down to molecules and atoms, will be shredded into oblivion.
Some physicists say that this could happen as soon as 17 billion years from now. Or another possibility is that, like 100 billion years from now, the strength of dark energy will diminish as time goes on, and the expansion of the universe will stop accelerating. In this case, if dark energy weakens, gravity might ultimately win the tug of war and pull all the matter in the universe back on itself. That result is referred to as the Big Crunch. But these days, a lot of bets are being placed on the Big Freeze. In this scenario, dark energy keeps the universe flying apart until everything gets so far flung that there's simply no thermodynamic energy left. There'll be no motion, no heat, no life, stars will burn out, new stars will stop forming, and the cosmos will dissipate into cold, dark nothingness. This party isn't expected to start for about 100 trillion years, though, so that's good news. But these aren't the only ideas, they're just the most popular ones. Some cosmologists think that as entropy in the universe increases, it will configure itself into something so complicated it will become a self-aware entity. So yeah, I'm with the guy who thinks the universe could become a giant brain. That sounds cool. But that's what's great about this stuff. Cosmologists are constantly bickering over questions like, is the universe even real? Are we real? How many universes are there? Is the universe going to recur over and over again in an endless cycle? Cycle of big bangs. Why can't you unscramble an egg? Because when you're trying to figure out the nature of the universe from a tiny rock in deep space, there are no stupid questions.
And that is the end of this segment, but we'll return after this break.
Making a cuppa?
Stop! How many cups of tea are you making? What? There's enough for 10 cups in there. Only boil the amount of water that you actually need. Very good, old boy.
That's right. The British are making less tea to conserve energy. Students can conserve energy, too.
A student's life often follows a pattern. Eat, sleep, study. During this routine, don't forget to make time for energy conservation. This will be the easiest thing you do all semester, and a little bit goes a long way. Do your laundry in cold water and hang clothes on standing dry racks or clotheslines instead of using electricity-intensive dryers. If a dryer is the only option, throw in a dry towel with wet clothes to absorb moisture and cut down on drying time.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9.
And we're back. The UN has just released its final grand unifying fifth climate change report, and the news is not good. Let's find out why.
This week, the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is convening in Copenhagen, leading up to the release of the long-awaited synthesis report on November 2nd. The synthesis report is the culmination of five-year effort of 830 authors and 1,200 other contributors and 3,700 expert reviewers, drawing on more than 30,000 pieces of research and 143 expert comments to produce an unprecedented body of scientific evidence to show climate change is happening now. It is already impacting on people everywhere, and that it is being caused by human activity, such as burning of fossil fuels. The facts are so conclusive that there is no wiggle room. Why this document is so important? The UN hopes to deliver a new global treaty on climate change at a meeting in Paris at the end of 2015. The IPCC synthesis report will, in the eyes of many, play a critical role in that treaty. With us to discuss the upcoming IPCC synthesis report and its significance is Chris Williams. He is a longtime environmental activist and professor of physics and chemistry at Pace University and the chair of the science department at Packer Collegiate Institute. Chris, welcome to The Real News again.
Thanks very much for having me on your show.
Chris, so we had this new report from the IPCC coming out on Sunday. What do you think will be the biggest takeaway from the report?
Well, it's putting together, as the name implies, the three different pieces that have come out over the course of this year to examine the physical science and the implications of the physical science for climate change on the world. And the draft report stated what was rather chilling as well as different was that the impacts were already being felt. And if they continued and the fossil fuel emissions continued to grow as they are, then the impacts would be severe, pervasive, and irreversible, in the words of the draft report. And so this is, for the first time, the kind of stark language that is coming in, being introduced by the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, set up to investigate this question 25 years ago. And so I think what will be very interesting is if the report retains the information from the previous three and from the draft about the carbon budget, about the fact that we've already emitted two-thirds of what we can if we want to stay within a 2°C limit. And in other words, we have to close down the fossil fuel industry over the next 20 years or so and take our emissions on a downward path instead of the accelerating upward path that they are currently on. So what will be key in the finalized report is if that language is retained, because many countries are trying to, you know, some of the biggest emitters, as you can imagine, are trying to get that removed from the final report to reflect their negotiating positions and their own industries.
Chris, after some 400,000 people demonstrated in New York and rallied against climate change in New York, and also when after Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the UN, held the climate summit, is there any more fire in the bellies of the leading states to address it? Is there a sense of urgency?
I mean, I think it's difficult to talk about a sense of urgency after two decades of negotiating, particularly as they've gone backwards from their starting positions. I mean, in 2011, they agreed to maintain the maximum increase in temperature above what has been true for the whole of human civilization of 2°C above the average. And yet they've taken no action to actually deliver on those promises. So I was kind of surprised that Ban Ki-moon was even part of the protest, because the UN is not doing anything in terms of bringing down the emissions. The individual countries, the major emitters, what was left out of the draft report was that 70% of world emissions come from just 10 countries, 50% from just two, United States and China. So I don't think those countries are showing any kind of urgency, and actually are two of the countries most determined to keep us on the current completely unsustainable path, which will lead to an absolutely disastrous situation for millions of people around the world, and, of course, the extinction of thousands of species and the destabilization of the whole climate as we have come to know it and as many other species have come to know it and evolve into. So it's I wouldn't say that there's any kind of fire under international leaders of any kind other than the amount of money cascading into the coffers of governments around the world from the fossil fuel corporations. On the other hand, there's plenty of fire from the 400,000 people who are in New York City, which is a fantastic step forward for the United States climate justice movement and the world to see that so many people in the United States really want the government that supposedly we elected to represent our interests actually represent our interests and not the interests of the corporations and the U.S. military and so on, but represent the interests of all the people who are going to be impacted by climate change, i.e. us.
Chris, ahead of the meeting in Copenhagen, the European Union announced a commitment to cut carbon emissions by 40% by 2030, I believe. Are there other such commitments being made from countries around the world? And I asked you offline before this meeting, you know, who are the countries that are leading the charge at the United Nations? And you said it was countries that are most affected by it, the island nations that are, you know, seeing their landmass disappearing, countries that are seeing sea levels increase, sea levels affecting their livelihood and their food supply. You know, it's probably countries that's really experiencing the increase in the ocean temperatures. So some of these countries are some of the poorest nations in the world. Mm-hmm. Tell me more about that, because I think people don't understand the gravity of the problem here.
A lot of the small island states, this is not a problem for the future. This is an immediate and urgent problem as they are inundated by higher seas because they're barely above sea level as it is. It is a reality. Or if you go to, for example, the indigenous communities along the coast of Alaska, where the permafrost is melting, and so villages or towns are being relocated away from a crumbling coastline. So I think that it's being felt all around the world in some of the most vulnerable communities in the global south and in the north, in indigenous communities, for example, as I mentioned, in Alaska. And so some of those states, like the small island states that you mentioned, are the ones at the forefront of saying, why aren't you doing more? Why are we the ones who are paying the price, even though we are the least responsible? And even though a climate fund was set up to facilitate a transfer of investment to developing countries to help them skip over the fossil fuel age and move into a more sustainable, renewable era of energy generation, that fund that was established with the agreement of the developed countries, they said that we will put in $100 billion a year, is empty. They have not put in hardly any money. And $100 billion a year sounds like a lot of money in many respects. And obviously it is a lot of money, but in the context of the global environment or in the context of the economies of countries, for example, you know, the U.S. gives $800 billion to the U.S. military every single year. It's a drop in the ocean. And unfortunately, some states are going to drop into the ocean unless they start getting some more money. So this technology transfer and investment in that technology transfer from the rich countries, who are all rich because in part they benefited from using fossil fuels, which is now causing the problem, has to be part of the demands for an equitable answer to the climate crisis, which means that billions more money has to be sent rather than taken from to the global south, from the north, based on the historical responsibility for emissions, equity, morality, and the basic idea that they won't be able to do it and can't do it without some of the money that has helped to make the rich world rich, or at least 1% of the top 1% of the rich world rich. And so I think that this is an urgent question that unfortunately is not being addressed because the countries who are pushing for more radical action are not large enough economically to make a change in the UN, which we know is really just dominated by the Security Council of 5 permanent members.
Right. And Chris, we know that the UN itself is a fairly ineffective body in terms of coming up with a binding agreement that can be monitored, evaluated, and so on. And all kinds of exceptions are always negotiated. For example, the Kyoto Agreement excluded the military carbon emissions of certain countries like the United States, which means that, the report, in spite of the fact that it was a massive body of literature reviewed and the conclusions drawn from them, it still excludes quite a bit of emissions that might be there. So is the problem graver than it is described by the IPCC report?
Well, I think people are experiencing around the world the gravity of the problem. And that's one of the reasons that 400,000 people were on the streets of New York. It wasn't just that, that we're not getting very much information. The mainstream media in the U.S. always presents it as a two-sided story, and yet it's not. The scientists are saying it's not. It's unequivocally ours, and we are in the middle of climate change, not some future problem. So people want to do something because they are seeing it in their lives. particularly anybody who's connected to the land and trying to use, for example, bioindicators to know when to plant, when to sow, when to reap, it's becoming very difficult because plant species, animals are moving their ranges. And so what was true historically is no longer the case. So I think that that's one of the things that is galvanizing people. And it's also in part changing the minds of scientists, because I think there's always been this idea amongst scientists that if we just present the science to world leaders, they will act. And yet, even as the science has got more and more definitive and the reports clearer and clearer about the depth of the problem and the extent to which this is a crisis of global civilization in the making, the our world leaders have shied further and further away from taking action. So it's clear that science first, or the idea that we can just present some facts as scientists and leaders will listen, is becoming, I think, increasingly seen as an obsolete idea, which is a good thing, because really what we're talking about is not just purely, or even mostly, when it comes down to it, technical scientific solutions, although they stem from science, is actually a social and a political question. Who has power and who doesn't, and how might we rearrange that equation, I think is something that has to be addressed at the same time as figuring out, well, what are good solutions from a scientific, but also a social perspective, and one that is based on equity and sustainability and justice.
Well, on that note, let's pause for a break. We'll be back after this.
There's only one way that old clunker is going to make you feel good again. Donate it to Bullying Canada. Check this out. Free towing or pickup of your old vehicle, a tax-deductible receipt, and a super easy process. Online at bullyingcanada.ca. Get rid of that old vehicle and feel good about supporting real solutions for change in your community. Donate your old or used vehicle to Bullying Canada today. Full details online at bullyingcanada.ca.
And we're back. And from one forecast of possible disaster to the dissection of a disastrous campaign for Mayor of Toronto by NDP Olivia Chow. Why does the left keep losing?
On Monday, John Tory, a progressive conservative, was elected to be the next mayor of Toronto, defeating the incumbent mayor's brother, Doug Ford, and former Democratic Party councillor and federal MP Olivia Chow. Now joining us to discuss the elections from Toronto is Leo Panitch. Leo Panitch is a distinguished research professor of political science at York University in Toronto. He's the winner of the UK Deutsche Book Prize for the Making of Global Capitalism, the Political Economy of the American Empire. Thank you so much for joining us, Leo.
Good to be here, Sharmini.
Leo, before we talk about John Tory and what his mayorship might mean, let's talk about the Fords. By all accounts, Rob Ford's mayorship and his candidacy was a comedy of errors, theatrical with a tragic ending. Why was Rob Ford and his brother Doug so popular among the working classes?
Well, not only the working classes, but certainly a good number of parts of Toronto, including areas where workers live, people in public housing live, areas where there are large immigrant communities even, supported him. And that has to do with the fact that these are Mussolini characters. They are themselves wealthy. They come from a very right-wing conservative party faction here in Ontario. They used to be associated with the Reform Party, which was a type of Tea Party movement in the 1990s that amalgamated with the Conservative Party here and moved it to the right. Our Prime Minister was associated with that, the current Conservative Prime Minister. And they make an appeal as populists of the right with very Mussolini-like overtones. to the poor, the disenfranchised, the marginalized, very large number of people, of course, in North America, as being anti-elitist and anti-establishment, although they are close friends with many right-wing people who are very much in the establishment and even in the federal government. And the left in Toronto, as is the case with social democracy everywhere and the Democratic Party in the United States, of course, the never presents itself as speaking for the marginalized, the poor, the ordinary worker in the name of being anti-establishment. And these guys, who in every sense are shysters in this respect, and are able to do this. And it's a kind of talk radio phenomenon. They get themselves heard to the masses through what Toronto has picked up from the United States by way of talk radio. And it has the same type of soundbite, know-nothing, you know, you're wasting our taxes kind of appeal, which is irrational in many ways. People are told they will save $100 in taxes a year, and they're not told that they won't have their potholes filled or their schools properly staffed. What's worse is, of course, they won't go after the telecommunication companies that add enormous costs onto people's needs in terms of television or the internet.
Leo,
so that's what we're facing.
Right. Leo, in terms of the, you know, growing appeal of the right-wing populism that you're talking about here, what's happening on the left that's allowing this to happen? Why isn't the left appealing to the working classes and the poor and the disenfranchised and immigrant communities that Olivia Chow, the NDP candidate here, could have actually embraced?
Well, they appeal to it in a whiny kind of, you know, there's a lot of poor people in Toronto, and in a policy way, but not in any mobilization kind of way. Not in a way that, heaven forbid, should speak of class struggle. Not in a way that, as the Fords do, breaks with the rules of the game. And people are fed up with the rules of the game amidst this crisis and under neoliberalism. They know they're getting shafted. And the NDP, and Olivia represented this in the worst way, tries to present itself as balanced and fair, et cetera, et cetera. And she went so far in congratulating her opponents last night, congratulating Tory, but also congratulating Doug Ford for the great race he ran, for congratulating him, for commending him on his determination. Well, what came to my mind was you could congratulated Hitler for his determination, for heaven's sake. That's not to say that Ford is comparable with that type of fascist. But you know, this is not the kind of politics that is going to catch on with people who are just fed up to their eyeballs with the existing system. You need to be able to speak in a way that captures their anger. And it's only the right that is doing this, not the quote-unquote reasonable left.
Right. And the media played a big role in the way that the issues were covered, in the way that the candidates were covered. Tell us more about that. How did the media? Mm-hmm.
To be fair, the media, of course, had a field day on Rob Ford's crack smoking and drinking and vulgar behavior in every possible respect. But they also called him out, especially the Toronto Star did, on his ridiculous lies that he had provided so many jobs and saved some taxpayers so much money, all of which was, pardon the expression, largely bullshit. But earlier, Doug Ford, his brother, who has been living in Chicago all these years until 4 years ago, running the Chicago franchise of their decal business, which they make a lot of money on selling to governments. You know, they do printing and provide paper and decals and so on to companies and governments, et cetera. The Globe and Mail, Toronto's quote-unquote national newspaper, did a massive investigatory story showing that Doug Ford had been a major drug honcho as a young man in his 20s and 30s. This earlier the media did quite a job on them. During the campaign, this was completely withdrawn. Rob Ford had a lot of sympathy because of his cancer from the media. And Doug Ford, his earlier life was never mentioned. Well, you can bet that had this been someone on the left who had had that kind of a past, there was any smell of that kind of a past from anyone on the left, that this would have been pulled out daily, and the opposition candidates would have mentioned it. But it went unmentioned when Doug Ford came in to run as mayor when his brother got ill.
So what now? Let's talk about John Tory and what we might expect from him as a mayor.
Well, as you said, Tory is a quote-unquote progressive conservative. That used to be the official title of the Conservative Party of Canada because they linked up with a wing of the progressive movement way back in the early part of the century for a period. He is a very middle-of-the-road conservative, but he's a conservative. And he made it clear that he wasn't going to raise taxes above the rate of inflation. He made it clear that he would not support the gay pride parade if queers against Israeli apartheid marched in the parade, etc. That's not to say he's an erudite, urbane, civilized human being. And he certainly has a campaign for public transit, a plan for public transit, which is ambitious. It involves some shenanigans in terms of how the money will be raised. But I think it's not impossible that he will be able to secure cooperation from the Liberal government here in Ontario, which is led by a relatively progressive Liberal woman. And who knows, even because of his connections with the Conservatives at the federal level, may be able to get something out of them. By way of solving Toronto's very great congestion problem, which everyone has agreed requires massive expenditure on transit infrastructure in the next 10, 15 years. More than that, he will not be as reactionary in the kinds of ways that the Ford brothers are. And that will be a bridge builder to some extent. We'll have to see whether the kinds of things that he says or that Olivia Chow said she would do for public housing, where Ford has a lot of his base because he does go there, both of them go there, and try to deal with people's cockroach problems. They are the kinds of politicians who really do show up on poor people's doorsteps and say, look, you've got water leaking from the roof in your public housing building. We'll deal with this. And they are constantly harassing the public agencies to do something about this, never calling for more money to be put in, mind you, more staff to be hired. But they do act, if you like, as poor people's spokesmen in the sense of raising the complaints. And we'll have to see whether Tory is prepared to do that kind of thing. He doesn't look like the type of guy who is.
And finally, Leo, I understand that John Tory has actually invited Olivia Chow and his other opponent to administer the city with him. What do you think of that?
Well, it's the kind of thing one says. He'll probably offer Olivia Chow a appointment in one of the city boards or agencies. I don't think Doug Ford will come on in this respect or be offered anything in this respect concretely. his brother, people should know, from his sickbed while taking chemo, when he withdrew from the mayoral race, did so exactly on the day in which he could put his candidacy down for his previous seat as a councillor in the part of Toronto that he's from. And, you know, he was elected overwhelmingly in that seat without having to campaign much. Although typical of him, he showed up in half a dozen voting booths in the weeks running up to the election. And in the early voting at poll booths, et cetera, which is an illegal thing for him to do. And he was slapped over the wrist for showing up there.
Leo, all very entertaining politics in Toronto. Thank you so
entertaining,
much.
Entertaining, but I must say, Sharmini, if you'll give me another minute, the fact that they got one third of the vote in a city like Toronto, which has been a very progressive city, and which has such a large, large immigrant population, and that he is doing so well in working class parts of the city, speaks to something that's going on right across the advanced capitalist world, and to some extent across the world. You're part of the world. Look at the BJP in India, mm-hmm. Where in the face of the bankruptcy of the traditional left, and in the face of the need to do more than protest, as the anti-globalization movement has done, but engage directly into trying to get into the state, in the face of those two failures, we are seeing the far right pick up the discontents of working people, of poor people, of marginalized people. And that is a very, very scary and dangerous thing, which should light the fire under everybody who watches the real news to get their stuff together and organize the types of political mobilizations and education that can compete with this.
Well, that's all the time we have this week. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish.
Hey there, listeners. You're listening to 101.9 FM CITR, and it's a beautiful day in Vancouver here, and hope you're enjoying the weather, and probably sitting at the beach, drinking some booze.